nothing quite as weird as just empty space, you know, if you're trying to think of geometries. Okay, so question, how are you guys doing? You're cranking through Compton Scattering. We got the matrix elements sketched out last week, so we're on track there. Any obstacles, questions there? Okay, so continuing with the standard model, we were doing some background on Yang-Mills series, and I wanted to take a look at the Yang-Mills action and derive the conserved nether current, and there are things that will come up in the couplings we write. What happens in as you gauge the theory is that the conserved current that you get from a global symmetry of an action becomes the thing that interacts with the gauge field when you gauge the theory. The analogy that you're familiar with is when you write the action for electromagnetism, you've got the F squared terms that tell you how the free photon propagates. And then you have a J dot A, an A mu J mu term, where J is the conserved current from the global symmetry from, say, the Dirac equation or something, wherever you started. And A mu is the gauge connection that you've introduced. So you get this J dot A thing that tells you how currents and gauge fields couple. And that J we can find from others. So let's take a look at that for the angle. In general, we have the simplest Yang-Mills action. We take a quarter the field strength. Anybody remember what indices we were using for the A, capital A? So here we're summing over all of the dimensions of the Leon's run. And then we can track up the Lorentz indices. And then we have a term, let's suppose we've coupled this to a Dirac field. So we have I slash minus M. Fine. And this D slash term, let's look at that in a little bit of detail. I think last time we talked about the covariant derivative. This is a phi bar gamma alpha. And then the covariant derivative d sub alpha of the spinner of psi is a partial of psi. And then we have the gauge field. We can do this with either g's or h's. Let's just go with the g's. That's good enough. So we introduce some connection one form. That'll be something like an H alpha A, and those are Lie algebra valued one forms, so we have some group generators, and those group generators are matrices that know how to act on psi. So the coupling to the gauge field, let me write this in two terms. We have a psi bar d slash psi. And then we have something like, let me pull this H out, H alpha A, that's the gauge field. And then that's contracted with psi bar gamma alpha generator psi. And if we put in indices here, this is, say, an A, B, kind of thing. Well, the bar on the psi is basically a metric. Let's write it as GAB on a psi B and a 5RA.
So something like that. And this thing
is the current, one for each generator. So, and then that's contracted with A. You know, this is similar to A alpha, J alpha in E&M. So this is the current, actually a collection of one current for each generator of the gauge group that is produced by the multiplex psi, and that would provide the source for F. So the field equation from this, if you vary the gauge potentials, vary H A alpha, and what you're going to get is a covariant derivative, a covariant divergence of the field strength equal to, I won't try to get the signs right here, but you vary this thing and you're going to get that J, okay, so your field equation looks just like electromagnetism, except there's one extra index here, because you get one of these for each symmetry. The other difference is that this covariant derivative is covariant with respect to the group transformation, the angles group. And that means that this is not just a partial, but there are going to be some H's coupled to F sitting inside that. And you have, this kind of covariant derivative. So there's this H coming in with F over on this side. Okay. Any questions on that?
Where's the beta on this thing?
Did I lose the beta?
Or call it something else? Yeah. If A alpha, F A alpha, oh, beta, or?
Beta, that's alpha. The Greek is the...
Oh, okay. Okay.
Lowercase Greek is just a space-time index. So we can even lower those for
but. So we have that H actually in the current, right? The H alpha A. This is just part of the current.
No, the current is just this.
Okay.
H, the gauge field couples to the current, just like A couples to J in electromagnetism. So you've got more of them.
I'm just trying to match indices here.
Yes. Okay, so this A is that A. That one. And the beta here is alpha there. The free alpha in this term. I changed it to beta for no good reason.
So you raised the index.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm mapping this side. So okay. It's just raised. So yeah, we can raise and lower the indices. Remember the metric on the big space is a Kronecker. We've got eta alpha beta. There's also a delta alpha beta, delta lowercase a b. We have three different spaces, three different metrics, and we can raise and lower, and it makes almost no difference because it's almost always the identity that stuff is. So yeah, I can put all of the Latin indices here up or down, and it wouldn't make any difference to numerically what's there. It's just matching the position. Okay. So let's show explicitly that this is a conserved quantity. What I want to do is a local gauge transformation. A global gauge transformation is sufficient. So let's use the Snodgrass theorem. So we want to apply this. Is it umlaut or is it NOE?
I think it can be either one.
Often an O umlaut is translated into other languages. English is an OE.
Right. Okay.
I'm wondering how the Germans would write her name. I don't know. It doesn't matter. We're not in Germany. Who cares? All right.
So, first step, vary the action. We want to do a general variation in the action here. What I want to do, in fact, is a sufficiently general variation. I don't want to vary a bunch of stuff that isn't going to matter. What's going to matter is the variation of, the gauge potentials, we certainly have to vary age and we have to vary psi. So let's carry out that variation and we'll see what happens. So when I vary age in the field strength here, I get two copies of the same thing. And what happens quite generally there is I get a covariance derivative of the variation of HA beta. And varying this, there are going to be two such terms. I don't have to explicitly anti-symmetrize because this is contracted with F A alpha beta, and F is anti-symmetric on alpha beta, so it imposes anti-symmetry here, so I can just pull the 2 out, and that's why we put the quark for the two factors of 2. One factor of 2 because there are 2 F, and then one factor of 2 because F is partial alpha of H minus partial beta of H alpha. So you get 4 terms. Okay, and then there's another H in the covariant derivative in this term, so I'm going to vary it to that one. And let me write this action as a half this way and a half. If I integrate by parts, I'm going to have a half psi bar in which d acts to the left. Here I'm differentiating psi bar. I'm still writing it this way with an arrow because the gamma matrix has to stay between the psi and psi bar to have a nice scalar. But I want the derivative to act on the psi bar. So think of this as just integrating by parts, so I get a minus sign and an M sign. And now I've written it symmetrically, so I've got one term where the derivative is on psi, one term where the derivative is on psi bar, and that way you don't have the, let's see, it's more symmetrical. When we do Nutter's theorem, we're really interested in the surface terms, and it's nice if you've integrated each thing equivalently by parts. Just that integrated term from integration by parts is what gives you the current. So you'll see it a little more clearly, probably. All right, so here we're going to get, let's do the current thing first. I, then we have I kind of d slash. That's going to give a del H. So I'm going to get this term right here with this del H. So there will be a variation of H A alpha times the term that I've bracketed there. Phi bar gamma alpha. Oh, sorry, I've already got the psi bar. Gamma alpha. A and psi. That's what it is. Okay. That's everything I get by varying H. Now, if I vary psi bar, I get a del psi bar here. I slash minus M psi.
What about the third term of your action?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, good. So, a half. my bar. Minus I. Okay, and then there's a term, but I need now the conjugate to this term. And G is so I'm gonna end up with this thing with a G dagger. What's G dagger?
G's are Hermitian, right?
Or they're Hermitian. Yeah, we're using the true lead generators here, not to feel dirty. Remember, we had an IG over 2 with an H, where an H is Hermitian. But the G's here, you know, I haven't gussied this up with coupling constants and stuff, so this is really the anti-Hermitian generator. So I'm going to get a minus sign when I dagger it. So I'll make this a plus. Then, let's see, which way does this act? So, I'm going to reverse everything. Looks like I just get a factor of 2. So, this psi has become that psi bar. The IG is Hermitian. So, that stays the same. Then I'll have the GA, I get a gamma A. Is Hermitian enough? I'll explain that in a second. And then I get this sign the usual way. So I just get the other half of the same thing. And I've lost the gel H. There. Now, these two confused. They don't know about each other. They're in different spaces. I just get rid of the factor of a half. What I mean by the gamma alpha being Hermitian enough, one of them is Hermitian, the other three are anti-Hermitian, but that's what the gamma zero in the psi bar takes care of, because the gamma I passing the gamma zero gives another sign and fixes it. So this thing always turns into itself when you take the dagger, just for the gamma matrix and psi bar stuff. So we've gone through that. So there's the other term. Get rid of the half. Okay. And then we have 4 terms here as we vary each of the spinners. You want to get all of the variations written free of derivatives. So, one of those places is here. Let's pull out a del. That was messy. Yeah. But let's go ahead and write it. So, we'll have the divergence of del HA beta FA alpha beta. Then let me go ahead and write all of the surface terms, all of the things that are total derivatives, and then we'll go back and subtract. So we have to subtract from this D of F. I changed my mind. let's do it the other way. Let me go ahead and subtract that term now. So I've freed up del HAB, and it's going to be multiplied by this covariant divergence of FA alpha beta. But then these two combine, I get rid of the half, and combine to give me, I pulled out a minus sign here, so I need another minus sign, then I phi bar gamma alpha GA phi. Except that needs to be a beta. And that A needs to go up. I'm just putting all the indices in the same position. So that's what we get after we integrate by parts. That's the full variation of the gauge field H. And then we have other terms from the phi variations I'll write in a second. But now this would be the field equation. This equals zero would be the field equation. If we just threw out the surface term, which is what we normally do when we're just finding the field equation. Then we have, we don't need to integrate this by parts. This one we have d of del phi, so we do need to integrate it by parts. This one we have a derivative of del phi. So it's these middle two that we integrate by parts. So what are we going to get? There's an I over 2 here, and then we'll have a d alpha of phi bar gamma alpha del phi there. So that's the surface term from this one. Then this one, when we integrate, we have a minus I over 2, and again we're going to have a d alpha of this time del phi bar and gamma alpha and phi. So those are the two terms that integrate to the surface. And then we have to subtract from here d acting on that, and subtract from this d acting on the phi. So we get, let's write this as I over 2. We can write this as phi bar and a d slash acting left, because I'm subtracting the thing acting on the phi bar. And then we have a del phi. This one, subtraction, gives a plus I over 2. And now the del phi bar comes out, and we have a d slash acting on phi. Okay. Then, what else do we have? We've got this term is just fine the way it is. That term's just fine the way it is. And then we have these two lonely M terms floating around. Let's just write them minus 1/2. There's an M phi bar del phi. And here's a minus 1/2. M del phi bar phi. Okay, there's the full variation. Any questions or criticism?
Do we need an arrow to the left on the last term of the second to last line?
Yeah. Right. Okay. And now I think we can carry out Mither's procedure, NIDTA. To symmetry.
And
all right, so what does that mean? What's going to happen there?
It's a little complicated.
For the guy, it's not so bad.
Because Psi is going to go to a gauge transformation, a general FUN gauge transformation of
E to the I.
So E to the, we can parameterize this any number of ways, but let's just introduce some real parameters with the, with the anti-Hermitian generators. Like that. That's a group element. That's a general group element depending on n real parameters. So, leave.
Okay.
And these are the anti-Hermitian generators, so I don't need the I because that's got it in. And that times psi, well, infinitesimal, this is equal to psi plus some epsilon a ga psi in the infinitesimal case. So del psi is equal to psi, sorry, this thing minus psi, so we just get the epsilon a ga psi. So that's the variation of psi. Well, that makes the variation of psi bar easy now. What's going to happen? Well, we get the same thing acting the other way. It's going to pick up a sine because G is in the Hermitian. So we'll still have the epsilon A, and we'll have a psi bar, and a minus sign, and a GA acting on the other side. Okay, then what happens to H? Well, we know what happens to H. Under gauge transformation, H prime, we worked out, is G H G inverse minus D G G inverse. That's not going to be pretty to work with. Let's see, what is it? So G is infinitesimal, so we're going to let G be 1 plus epsilon A CA. And we substitute that in and keep terms only of order epsilon. That's not so bad. You know, if you try to impose a gauge condition in a non-Abelian gauge theory, you've maybe chewing on that a while. It's difficult. I tried to do that for a while at one point, and I'm not sure. I might have been able to get the Lorentz gauge condition to hold with a covariant derivative. So the covariant divergence of the gauge field vanished. I won't swear that that's a theorem. I don't remember if I actually was able to show that or not. It's tricky to impose gauge constraints in a non-Abelian gauge theory. You've got to bump a lot, and then applying the residual gauge condition to some further constraint. Yeah, forget it. The thing is, this 50 Cg inverse in a non-Abelian theory, that's going to contribute some arbitrary other gauge field, not the one you're trying to fix. So you're always bringing in these other gauge fields. It's very tricky to use this very nonlinear condition to, globally impose some gauge condition. Infinitesimal, no problem. That's fairly simple. But, how much gauge condition can you impose infinitesimally? You want something that you can just say, oh, that component of H is zero, because we gauged it to zero. Very hard to do. Okay, so back to the gauge condition here. H prime infinitesimally is, we're going to have one from each of these. Of course, the inverse is the same thing with a minus sign here. So we're going to have an H, and then we're going to have what's actually the commutator between, let's see which way it goes. There's going to be a GH term, so we'll have an F1A, GA, and an H. And then on the inverse, we're going to have an H with minus that same factor, so the two together give us a commutator of the generators with H. And then we have the minus dG, G inverse. That one happily is simple because the dG gives us the dE, the epsilon rather. And that already makes the term of order epsilon, so the G inverse only contributes to the identity. The rest of that term is second order. So this is what we get.
Why do you get a commutator again?
Because it's the first term. There are really four terms there. One of them is second order.
Well, one's a minus.
The inverse has a minus sign here. G inverse is one minus that.
So we're plugging that in for the top.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just substitute those two into this expression.
Okay.
And one term is quadratic. You drop it.
Oh, I see.
One term is the H again, and the other two are opposite signs.
Oh, okay.
And that term on the opposite sign. So it's just a constant.
And then D of 1 is 0, right? Okay.
Do you want me to write that? I'll write it out if you guys want to see it. Are you following this? Or?
Okay, I think it's
let me write it out for Juan. So, this, okay, I'm going to use these infinitesimal expansions here to write this. This is 1.S1AGA H 1 minus S1A. Have I finished answering your question?
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Minus D of 1 plus S1AGA times the inverse is 1 minus, and I'll choose a different index here. I'm multiplying those, but I don't want the same index. I should have done that back here, too. Let's call this a V. It's just a dummy index. I can call it anything I want, but I should call it something different. Then this first term gives me four pieces, right? The two identities just give me an H back. Then the identity here and the epsilon term there give me epsilon A, G A, H, times the identity and just drop it. Then the identity here and that epsilon term gives me a minus H epsilon D, G D. Then I have a term that's an epsilon A, epsilon B, G A, H, G, B. And that's order epsilon squared, epsilon infinitesimal, maybe I can drop that. Then over here, a similar thing happens because D of 1 is 0, I get a D of epsilon A, G A with the identity. And then this term, I have minus D epsilon A G A with epsilon B G B, and that one is order epsilon squared as well, and I drop it. So what I end up with, these two of the just become a commutator. And so we get this. So
do you say the sign the last one must be plus, right?
Yeah. Right. Positive almost zero.
So now if we have a global transformation, we can drop D of epsilon A.
Yeah, we're gonna drop that, but thanks, Michael. I'm gonna wait to drop it because it combines with some other stuff that I want to all drop together.
Okay.
I'm not sure what happens if you don't drop that. I mean, it still has to be true. But what happens, let me see. And worry a little about that term, where there's a D of some epsilon stuff, and it's a covariant D, and I think I probably want to drop that whole thing. But let's press on and see how that plays out. So for now, we're totally general, just infinitesimal. So del H, here we found del phi. Here del H is H prime minus H. So it's just the commutator. And let's see, do we know what the commutator is? Sure, we know what the commutator is. We have an epsilon A. I can pull out the coefficient H is a 1 form, and it's of the algebra valued 1 form, so I can pull out a B. So here, H I can write as HA, or HB, sorry, GB, the algebra valued 1 form. So really, I'm looking at the commutator of two generators. And that's just a structure constant, C sub A, B, C, G, B. So the commutator just gives me a structure constant.
H is H, B, G, B.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, remember H is a B algebra valued 1 form. So, you know, there's a DX alpha, H alpha, B, G, B. You know, there are both things associated with it. So I'm still suppressing the DX because I don't need it here, but I'm keeping that generator to go ahead and do the commutation.
Okay.
And, you know, this is the kind of game you play when you've got so many spaces at once. I've lost count, but there are a bunch of different spaces here. You suppress the indices, you're not, you know, where's, you know, like the DX really doesn't come into this, just everything inside the one form, so, you know, why carry around a bunch of DX alphas? However, I am looking at commutators of group generators, so I put in and go ahead and expand over that index so I can see what the generators are doing. You just expand the one that you need. So, then we have minus B, that's one A. Alright, and, oh, that, GA, I can write. Yeah, here's what I was thinking of. Minus quantity D epsilon A minus. All right, since I'm going to shuffle the indices on this, I want to pull out a common GA. So I'm going to write this as epsilon. I'm going to interchange C and A. So this becomes a CB, pressure constant C goes CBA, GA. And now if I interchange C and B here, I pick up a minus sign, and that becomes a plus. So I have E epsilon A plus C. So I'm interchanging the B and C, so this will be B, C, A, H, B, epsilon, C. That's the covariance derivative of the gauge covariance derivative of epsilon. So it's minus the covariance derivative, covariance exterior derivative, epsilon, A, contracted with G, A. So this is what I was thinking of. Yes. So, you know, we can make F1 covariantly constant and, you know, throw that term away. So, we're really not looking at the gauge field. Well, you know, of course we're not looking at the variation of the gauge field because we're supposing we're doing a global variation and, you know, the gauge field is unnecessary in a global symmetry. So in fact, we're going to toss this whole variation out. The del H is irrelevant if you're doing just the global symmetry. There is no gauge field if you're doing the global symmetry. So, you know, we don't want this to contribute. We could do another whole procedure in the locally symmetric theory and see what happens. I'm not sure what happens. I mean, Nether hasn't promised us anything, but there must be some consequences to that. So perhaps some identities that are true and difficult to prove or something, I don't know. You know, something will happen, but it may not matter to us what it is. Okay. Now, I'm still on the other board here. I'm going to have to erase something.
Let me get this board.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right.
I just want to keep the variation over there and substitute in. I'll do it in pieces. I'll erase the top and rewrite the bottom and then erase the bottom.
Okay.
You think take advantage of planning. Okay. So
I need four more whiteboards in here.
Yeah, really.
We should just get really high gloss white paint. Just paint the walls with. Just make the walls out of marker boards.
Andy actually used to use his bathroom for writing stuff on the walls.
Yeah. And window, you could write on windows too.
Right.
So you can use these okay on windows.
We used to be upstairs in the fourth floor here. People would write on the windows because.
Oh yeah, there were windows all along the one wall. Yeah. that's a serious loss. Although I don't know, maybe you could just go ahead and write on the wall sociology. I don't know. So that's number one. What's number two?
For
restrictive solution.
So restrict. Okay, and what that does, let's see if we can spot it here right away. The restriction to solutions, okay, this was our field equation, right? The coefficient of del H in general, that's zero when we restrict the solution. Okay, down here, of course, the surface terms aren't, but the integrated by parts stuff, all of this bottom stuff here ought to assemble itself into the field equation.
Exactly.
And let's just look at it. Let's look at del slash bar first. If we look at this term and this term, that is another copy, I'm underlining the wrong stuff, exactly backwards from what I said, del psi, where's del psi? Here's one, and here's one, and hang on, I've confused myself now, but let's see. Del psi bar. Because then the Dirac equation looks sort of normal. Del psi bar, and del psi bar. These two terms are one half I d slash psi minus m psi. That's exactly another copy of this thing. So these two terms look exactly like that one. And they are, in fact, the Dirac equation for psi. So those are going to be zero. The same thing happens with the del psi term. These two terms, del psi, we have minus d psi to the left on psi bar, minus m psi bar is exactly the conjugate Dirac equation for psi bar. So all of those last two lines vanish when we impose the field equation.
Can you say that again, please? from the point where we selected psi bar, or del psi bar.
So del psi bar, the underlying thesis.
Right.
This is the Dirac equation here. That's going to be zero.
Oh, okay. So
right. And if you look at these two terms, they assemble into another thing that looks exactly like that. We just get to the half, because we've got I d slash psi here minus m psi there. Just pull the del psi off to the left, and everything
right.
That remains is a half times the Dirac equation. So this is exactly the same as that, and they both vanish when we impose the field equation.
Thank you.
So we have del F is identically 0 by 0.1. We've restricted to a symmetry of the action, by definition, that leaves del F 0. This has to be, then, whatever we have left once we set the field equation to 0, which will be just three terms. We have d alpha of del H. Well, we know what del H is. It's minus the derivative of the variation upon A with a G. Del H, but now this was HA, so it's a free A. That's the coefficient. And it's covariant derivative beta. So that's really what we get. And then we have an F A alpha beta. Like that. Whatever that is. That's one term. Then, what's next? This middle line. We have I over 2 d alpha of 5 r gamma alpha, and then del psi, let's go look at what it was in EAGA psi. F1A GA psi. And finally, we had minus I over 2 D alpha of del psi. Well, what was that? That had a minus sign in it. F1A. Then 5R GA. And then we're back down here to gamma alpha psi. And we notice those two terms are the same, and they're exactly the current we want. So, global symmetry. So, our covariant derivative of the variation is 0. And what we're left with is the integral of d alpha for an arbitrary constant epsilon a, we get I phi bar g a gamma alpha phi as the current. So this thing is the current, conserved current, so this divergence, covariant divergence now, is 0. And so, since epsilon is an arbitrary constant, we pull it out, and now I can erase this lower part. And we get J, put the A anywhere we like, I'm going to go ahead and leave it down. The conserved current is I phi bar GA gamma alpha phi as claimed, and we have covariant exterior derivative of each of those conserved currents. So everything works just as we really like it to work.
How are we getting D of D again? Or,
what do we do with that? I'm taking a global symmetry, so I'm setting that point to 0. Right? So, where did it come from?
Right.
It came from the variation of H. Okay, that DE, that was the variation of H beta A.
Oh, okay.
Right? Which, you know, wouldn't be, that field wouldn't even have been there if we were just doing the global
theory. So you pull out the variation of H for that term? For all the terms, you pull out the variation of H for all these three terms. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. That's the H variation. The rest of the field equation.
Is it arbitrary whether the current has an I in it or not?
Yeah, you'd like it to be... Yeah, you'd like it to be real. So if you take the conjugate of this, right? Ig is Hermitian. So this is going to become a psi bar, gamma alpha. Ig is Hermitian, so you get g back and you get psi. So this is real.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the only reason, you know. It's conventional, but you'd think of the currents as measurable things. Okay, I think this is as much as I want to do in general on Yang-Mills theories. So, you know, that's funny. we'll, as we do SU3 and SU2 now, we'll go through some of this again, or a little more explicitly maybe, although not much more explicitly, for those two specific examples. Where we'll write the generators explicitly. And we'll probably want to identify at some point the conserved currents and so on, but we'll be able to spot them right away because we know they look like this. So take a deep breath, ask any questions you've got, and we'll start on SU3. Well, we'll start on the construction of the standard model. So I'm going to go back to the gauging and pick the specific gauge group that we're interested in. Y'all ready?
We have as many currents as we have generators.
Generators, yes. Which is the same as the dimension of the Lie algebra.
So U1 is 1, and SU2 is 3.
Yes, exactly. And SU3 is 8. Okay. You're good over here. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Did we define last time the covariant derivative with the structure constant in it? I can't remember. Because you have a structure constant here, the CBCA.
Yeah, we worked through that after you left. The adjoint representation has that.
Okay.
Right, this is the covariant derivative in the adjoint ring.
Okay.
So where, remember, the covariant derivative is defined with the commutator mm-hmm. with H, then you pick up the structure constant.
Okay. Okay.
And, right, let me just make these comments. So what we do is we take the G's to be, right, if we have an n-dimensional group, we take an n-dimensional representation of the group, and we define the matrices. I think the other way around works possibly better. To be the structure constant. So, should we look to this guy, or would you guys be horribly bored? Okay, who was here when we worked through this? I forget what we did. Was it Jeff and Joe? You mind if I run through a little bit of this again? What we didn't show is that this actually is a representation of the group. So if you look at the commutator of two of these, take GB with, let's say, GD, right? If I make this identification, what that is a C, that's the CA, so now I want a C with the A up, and then I need a D and probably an E down. So this will be, I'm summing on A, so I have a, I'm looking at the CE component of the commutator. Then I subtract it in the opposite order, so that's going to be the D here, D there, and B there. Like that. And now, let's see.
best to write these in the opposite way. Let's write that. Let's think which way it's going to go here. Yeah, let's flip this around so we've got E, D, A, B, A, B, C. And so A is sum, so we've got E, D, and B down. And I'll do the same thing here, and I'm going to change the sign, I think. So that this is D E A C A D C. So I still have the B and the E and the D as free down into these. The C is up, the A is sum. Now, this is two-thirds of the Jacobi identity. Do you remember the Jacobi identity? You get two Cheshire constants cyclically summed on just those three indices. So the Jacobi identity says that G A with G D G C and cyclically equals zero. So we cyclically permute A, B, and C. So we have B, C, A, and we have a term C, A, B here. Well, this is not hard to work out. This is just G, A with C sub B, C, D, G, D, and cyclic. And now I've got another commutator here, so I have a C, B, C, D, and then this gives us C, A, D, E, G, E, and cyclic. So what I get is an identity. Everything has a G, E here, but I get C sub B, C, D, C sub A, D, E. Plus, now I'm cyclically permuting A, B, C, so B goes to C, C goes to A, and A goes to D. And then I do it again here. C goes to B, C goes to A. A goes to D, and D goes to C. And all of that on a GE is zero, so all of that is zero. So that's the Jacobi identity. That has to be true for any algebra. It's an integrability condition. That's the thing that gives you associativity in the group, if you actually work way backwards. But notice that we've got two-thirds of that here, so all of this has to be equal to minus the third piece. So here we've got EDD, here's EDB cyclic. So we're missing which one? The one where D is first, and then D comes next. So we have A, C, and then from A here, then C, B, E, C. Okay, but that is just, okay, D, D, that's part of the structure constant, so we have a C, D, D, A, and we'll see whether we want the minus sign or not. Let's flip these two next to the plus, and then call that G A, the A component. So we have the algebra. So the structure constants of a simple group, I mean, you know, an abelian group, obviously you can't do this. There is no adjoint representation because those are all zero. But for a simple group or semi-simple group, you have the adjoint representation, which is an n-dimensional representation of the Lie algebra of an n-dimensional group. And that's the representation that acts on n-dimensional vectors. And in particular, back here, this gauge field F1A, the variation of the gauge field F1A, that's an n-dimensional vector. That's the
dimension of the gauge group. So the way to differentiate that one is with the adjoint representation. And that's why the covariant derivative involves the C, because the covariant derivative here is defined, okay, if we differentiate some vector in the Lie algebra, right, call that D of G. Well, G prime is GV, G inverse in the adjoint representation. It's not just G times V as we did in the fundamental representation. You require two because this is actually a second rank object, right? This object has two free indices on it because of the two on that G. Right? It's got those free indices. So you need a G and a G inverse to transform a vector in this representation. And what we find is the way to write the covariant derivative in that case is to add the commutator of the gauge field with C. So instead of just dV plus hD, now we need a commutator. And that commutator, since each of these is an element of the algebra, gives a structure constant. So this is what becomes d of dA plus h dC, structure constant dCA, as the covariant derivative in the adjoint representation. And we went through the proof last time, Jeff and Joe and I went through the proof that in fact is covariant. It's very similar, same structure as the proof we did for the other representation, only you end up with about twice as many terms because of the commutators. But you keep track of things and it sorts out. So this is the adjoint representation.
Should that be like CE, the variant, the last A? Yeah, two A's for the indices.
GA in brackets there should be C, and then a down E.
Okay. You've been sitting there looking worried all the time. I'm sure we're worried about this. Yeah. You're right.
Okay.
Good. Okay. So, let me get this out of your way. Any other questions on general Yang-Milde stuff?
Definition of Yang-Mills is always SU, special unit series?
You know, probably most people out there think of it that way. There's no reason you can't do the same thing with any of these groups. Let's say semi-typical Lie groups. All of this will go through just fine. You can use the Killing metric to construct that quadratic action. When I say a Yang-Mills theory, I usually think of that F star F action for a semi-simple Lie group. There's no restriction for, certainly for the classical theory, there's no need to restrict to a compact group like SUN. So you could do it for the conformal group, or Poincaré group. What you get is not general relativity, because you're writing a quadratic action. And that introduces extra terms. But you can certainly write down the theory and say, well, what does this mean? Okay. Let's do SU3. I'm forgetting. Let's do the standard model of gauge theory. Have you got everything? Thank you. overall group, the, well, we'll just do Poincaré. I'm not going to try to do too formal gravity on all of this. So Poincaré across U1 dot SU2 dot SU3. Now, it might help this even right here to have some names for these guys. The U1 symmetry is named hypercharge. So when we write a covariant derivative for that, just like the electromagnetic current, we usually put an E, the charge of the electron, times the 5R gamma alpha 5 for the electric current of a spinner field 5. Here, we're going to put a capital Y as the charge, and that's a hypercharge. It's nice to have a name for this thing because it helps emphasize that this U1 is not the U1 of electromagnetism. We're going to get electromagnetism out of this theory, but it's not the gauge field of this U1. The gauge field of this U1 is part of the electromagnetic potential. So, and we'll see how that emerges when we do the big thing. SU2 is, let me be a little more precise here. Let me call this weak hypercharge. Because there's also a hadronic combination of quantum numbers that's called hypercharge, and I want to distinguish from that. So, just to be totally clear, I'm talking about weak hypercharge here. Then the SU2, that's an electroweak symmetry. That's got a little bit of the photon in it. Let's just call it electroweak. Let's see. We'll need coupling constants for these. I think I separate out a G and a G prime as coupling constants for these two. Then SU3, often you'll see a sub C here. It's SU3 color symmetry. Now, we never see color. Right. The quarks have a quantum number called the color quantum number. It's red, blue, or green. And the only combinations of quarks that we see as free particles in nature, things like the proton or the pi meson, they're either a quark anti-quark, where you'll have a blue and a blue bar, so there's no net color, or you have one red, one green, and one blue, or they're anti-colors. So that in an anti-symmetric combination, so it's a singlet, it's a color singlet, so it has zero net color. So we haven't ever measured that quantum number directly. There are other SU3s in field theory, in higher energy particle physics. There's an SU3 that applies to counting the states that you're expected to see constructed from the up, the down, and the strange quark. These are the lightest quarks. So we see lots of particles that are combinations of those. And they fall into multiplex of an SU3, where the three are treated on an equal footing, and you can do unitary mixings of the three wave functions. And depending on what symmetry those mixings take, you get different particle combinations. So you get protons, or you get pions, or you get decaplets and octets and the eightfold wave kind of stuff. Which is something we can go through, but that's independent of the standard model. That's looking at different ways those quarks can combine. It may be that, as we discussed, the strong interaction, we should take a look at what happens if you mix those around. But it's a different SU3. It's an approximate SU3, whereas, as far as we know, this one we've backed. The SU3 color, we've seen no violation of. The SU3 that mixes the up, down, and strange part relies on neglecting mass differences between those three quarks. Well, they don't have the same mass. It's not an exact symmetry of nature, but it is a good way to classify particles. Okay, so these are our different symmetry groups. And we consider the quotient G mod everything with 1 on the fiber, which will be the Lorentz group and U1 FU2 and FU3. The procedure is going to be just what we did for the group. The only difference here is that the instead of a single FUN, what we have is a direct product of three unitary groups. And the only difference that makes, you know, it's not much difference because each of those three is a simple group. The direct product of three simple groups is a semi-simple group. And the Killing metric is still non-degenerate for a semi-simple group. It's just sort of block diagonal. And all the rest of the stuff we've talked about goes through. If we introduce connections for each of these separately, we're going to add the connections for the different pieces. They don't really see one another. You can just add them and proceed on. So what do we get? Well, to carry out this quotient, we need the Lie algebra. So let's find the Lie algebra. So for the Lorentz part of the group, now the generators of each of these four subgroups, they all commute with one another. You know, it's a direct product, they don't care about the others. So for the Lorentz group, we have our usual MAB and the translation generators T, the usual relationship, maybe ETD. Let's not write all of this, but delta CP, MAD, plus, etc. And we've got MAD. PC, what did we decide? There was a delta here. Anybody remember the sign? No, there's some constant here. And a P is commute. So that's the non-trivial part of the algebra. Then for U1, we have
one generator.
Well, it's just a multiplicative thing. It's the Y, right? That Y will be our generator for the hypercharge symmetry. For FU2, let's take a copy of the Pauli matrices. So I'll call them tau so we don't confuse it with spin, but this is, let's normalize them so we just have an I epsilon ijk, tau k. That might be a half times the Pauli matrices or something.
We don't want real restriction cuts.
No, they're, take them Hermitian. They're still Hermitian.
Okay.
So Hermitian, but normalized with a half of the Pauli matrix. Okay, for FU3, so that's the algebra of everything so far. The Y is commute, of course. So let me stick that in here. No, Y is commute. Everything is right. Then, for FU3, we'll take the Gell-Mann matrices. And it's pretty much the basis that we just talked about for FUN, only for these, we can just write it down. Let's call them lambda. Anybody remember what I used in the notes for the index?
You used G prime, or G tilde, then.
For the lambda. Was it like an I, a lowercase Latin, or? All right, lowercase. uppercase Latin for now. But anyway, that index runs 1 up to 8, right? N squared minus 1, these are 3-dimensional, so 3 squared minus 1 is 8 generators. Traceless Hermitian matrices. Lambda 1, we can do the I minus I thing here. Oh, no, sorry. First one is 1, the real one. Then lambda 2, we put the I's in the same position. Lambda 3, I'll write down what I think they are here, but you know, what I have in this PDF online is those are the actual Galois matrices that I checked somewhere. So those will be right if these aren't. So we put ones off diagonal there. And the 4 we can put I and minus I. Lambda 5, you can come down 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. Lambda 6, we can do minus I and I in the same position. And then there are 2 diagonal ones. Lambda 7, we can take to be 1 minus 1, just like we did before. But lambda 8, we're going to use Galois' choice of 1, 1, minus 2, give or take sign convention. So I believe these are the 8 Galois matrices.
Do you have to normalize this last one? It's got 3 entries, so.
It's traceless, what, an overall?
One called normalization or something?
Like a what do we want? 1 over a half? Okay, if I square it, take this. If I square it and take the trace, I'm going to get 6. So I'd really like to get 2, so I might want 1 over the square root of 3 here. Right, then I believe these are normalized so that the trace of lambda I, lambda j is twice the lambda. Alright, if you multiply any 2 of those, it's traceless unless you square one of them. If you square one of them, then you get something with 2 ones on the diagonal, and so the trace will give you 2. And I think I mentioned before, I put a lot of exercises into the PDF online. You know, I think that's one of them, and it's just certain you can stare at it and see that that's the case, but, you know, wouldn't hurt to check a couple of them. See if we got it right. But these are the generators of SU3. So notice that this is one definition of the Killing metric, or really we can define the Killing metric to be a half that, so we just have a Kronecker. So we've got a basis where we can easily check what the Killing metric is. The more I write of this, the more sure I am that I did not use an I index in the notes, so it's something else there. Okay. You can work out the algebra of those. I think I'd probably put that as an exercise. You're doing the general lecture to anyone. So,
yeah, just take that. You're
sticking
to it.
Specialized. Oh, okay. Reference problem 2. Here it is. Okay. The pressure constant, however, I'll stay consistent here. But we're going to change the index sometime. Lambda I, commutator lambda j. What we really need is, let's put an I in because these are Hermitian, not anti-Hermitian. So then we have some structure constants, F, I, J, K, and give us a lambda K. And if I use the Killing metric to lower an index FIJK is, of course, just delta KL FIJL, then FIJK is totally anti-symmetric. So that square bracket one means anti-symmetrized. With a normalization of 1 over 3 factorials, so just all permutations with plus and minus signs divided by 6. That's what the square bracket means. The square bracket around any set of n indices is anti-symmetrized over those n indices. Parentheses around a set of indices means symmetrized, so you just do the same thing with plus and minus. Okay, so you can check once you've found the structure constants that in fact that array is totally anti-symmetric, and that comes in handy sometimes. All right, now what are we going to say about all this? We find the dual once more. These are going to be our gauge fields, so let's name them carefully. What do I want to call them? So for M and T, we have the usual choice. So this will give us a delta HD DD. Then TA, B is Ronecker TA. Then for the we hypercharge, we'll take Y with the generator, let me just call it the one form B, one. For the remaining electroweak generators, we have tau as the generators, let's take the gauge fields to be one form BI, and that would be Ronecker IJ. So, remember, these are one form, so this is a B alpha, ultimately it will be the X alpha, BJ is going to be a B alpha J, the X alpha. They're one form, so these will be the electroweak gauge fields. In terms of these, we'll write the W plus and minus, the Z naught, and the photon. Then, for the strong interaction, clearly we want a different index here. Let's see, what do I call them? What does G stand for?
Group element.
Gluon.
Oh, okay.
I guess everything's a G, but couldn't stand for anything out of the sun. That G has the gluon today, until we forget. But those will be the gluon fields. And those, of course, are one part. So, we have gluon fields, G, alpha, and there are 8 vector fields there. And these are all pretty tightly constrained by the structure of the gauge theory. We write the Maurer-Carton equation. And let's see what happens. About that I, but let's not worry too much about it. I think we'll be okay here. So we get B omega AB is omega CB omega AC. The usual space time structure equation. Flat so far. We're going to keep it flat. Then what do we have? dB is zero, no no structure constant for live commute. If I take d of the i's, I'm going to get, remember we have a minus a half, so it'll be a minus I over 2, because there's an I in our structure constant. These F's are they real, imaginary, what are they? They probably fix up the I at any rate. Let's take a J, K, I, and then we'll have a B, J, which should be A here. Then for the, what's left? The gluon. Oh, I'm sorry, I used the wrong one, didn't I?
This is
an S1.
Different I's, right?
If there's still an I.
Right, we have an I for imaginary and an I for index.
Uh-huh. You'd rather not?
Well. There
we go. And then the G's, here's where we get the F. A, B, C, A. None of those is I, so we're safe. And we have G, B, which is C. And then we generalize to get the Cartan equation. All the connection forms. That's going to add here the Riemann curvature 2 form. It's going to add here the torsion. It's going to add here some field. Ooh, what do I want to call these? I carefully thought out names for all these things. Let's see.
I can look it up.
I don't want to call it F. I want to save F for later. Let's see, I suppose this one could be an FA, a two-form FA. Let's call these G and H. So there's some two-form H that when we generalize this B for hypercharge, dB is no longer zero, so it's going to be some two-form H. Here, we'll call this some two-form GL. So with these, those are the Cartan equations. That's writing them all twice. That's the Maurer Cartan, that's the Cartan. Keep it simple. And then simplifying to Minkowski phase. So we're going to take the curvature and the torsion equal to zero, and just as we got for FUN, that's going to give us vanishing spin connection, since we're going to work in Cartesian coordinates, and it's going to give us a solder form that's just differential of the coordinates. So there exists an orthonormal, an exact orthonormal frame field, so we're in class today. And now we have three gauge fields, and their curvatures in a fiber bundle structure over a flat space time. And we sort of know what to do with that. So now we back off and look at these one at a time. We can immediately write down a candidate for the action. And it's going to have a problem. So we're going to spend, the rest of, I don't know how many weeks, fixing the problem. So let's write an action for this. We know the kind of thing we can write. know, we know that there are multiplets, you know, and we'll dig into those multiplets, you know, next time. I don't want to start looking in detail at the strong interaction and the color and looking at what the gauge blue ones do today. But let's try and write down an action, and maybe I'll list some of the things that go wrong. We know the kinds of gauge fields, I'm sorry, the kinds of tensors that exist over these spaces. It's the same thing we had for SUN. So there are lots of tensor fields we could write. There are a very few that we're going to write because they're enough. And let's see what happens. So, a trial action. Let's just go for it here. We'll be totally clear that this isn't going to work in several regards. But we're going to add a quarter of the square of the field strength. So we're going to have FA alpha beta for the blue ones. And we'll have a quarter G I alpha beta G I alpha beta for the three intermediate vector bosons, and we'll have H alpha beta squared, quarter H alpha beta squared for the hypercharged gauge field B. And we'd like to couple this to some spinner field. So we'll write phi bar I d slash minus m phi, and let's see, what kind of multiplets are we going to get? Well, we should have some triplets, so we expect to have some over color triplets here. So let's have some where we write A is either red or green or blue, so summing over colors. We could also put those into some weak doublets. So I equals 1 to 3. So we, you know, we could have pairs of colored triplets. So we can have something like that. You know, there could also be some hypercharge associated with that. So we just put the hypercharge gauge field into that covariant derivative, and these guys will couple to the hypercharge as well. So we might want to stick a charge in there. Let's see, now the charge will come into the covariant part of the covariant derivative. So each of these might have some amount of hypercharge associated with it. And we could add other spinners as well at the same time. And we can add anything else that's gauge invariant. If we find we need it to accurately describe things, then, well, we will. Okay, so far, what does this describe? We have 8 massless gluons. We have 3 massless intermediate vector bosons. Let's just call them which bosons. One massless hypercharged boson. And we have spinners
let's see, we've got lots of spinners. Let's see, how many would this be? This would be 3 times 2 is 6. So we have 6 colored equal mass well, they have color, so we better call them quarks. Then we have some things, now we know what those other spinners are. Now if we try looking at that, we see that we better have some 1 through 3 of some other spinner fields. Let's call them chi just for now. I, B, Y, minus M, chi, I. Okay, what's the difference between these? Okay, these have a color index on them. So that means they're going to combine and make strong interacting particles, mesons and baryons. So those are going to be quarks. These only interact weakly, so these could be the leptons. So we have, well, how many did we introduce here? Sorry, these should be doublets. Quark, these are doublets of triplets, triplets of doublets. So the doublet here, for each A, we're going to have like up and down quarks. Oh, let's see, that's not nearly enough. Let's add, thumb over up and charmed and top, right, the 3 families. So we're going to replicate all of that 3 times for the 3 families. So each quark comes in red, green, and blue. These pairs, for the up, this pair gives the down, for the charm, that gives the strange, and for the top, it gives the box.
It's pretty another index, right?
let's see. No, I need another name. Yeah, okay, so let's call it Q. So, we'll let Q be which family. And then here we have families of leptons, so, we have L equals electron, muon, and tau. So we have those 3 families of leptons and their associated neutrinos in these couples. So something like that for the particle structure. So let's see, that gives us 3 families of 6 colored equal mass quarks in doublets, in weak doublets. And then the fermions, we have 3 families of, each family has 3 families of 2. These are equal mass lepton doublets. Okay, so what we've written down describes that, and you can immediately point to several problems. Start pointing out problems. I'll let you identify them. What's wrong with this picture?
Equal mass.
Yeah. Okay, so we're gonna introduce a fix for that. That's gonna lead us to introduce Yukawa couplings. We'll talk about those later, but that's gonna be the fix. We'll get into that after we talk about the Higgs. What other problems?
Can you write 2 indices on H? Can I do that?
Sorry, what?
Write 2 indices on H.
It's a 2 form.
Oh, okay.
It's
okay.
This gauge field here.
Okay.
It's this field string.
Okay. Oh, right. Never mind.
One other problem is pretty glaring, Karen.
Weak force?
What about?
It violates CP and...
Good. Okay. The weak interaction must violate parity. And as we've written it, it was not. This is an even parity action. We have the means, and we'll discuss how to introduce parity breaking. That wasn't the obvious one I was thinking of. That's subtle.
Well, bosons are not massless. Well, massless.
Yeah. Which?
Weak bosons.
Weak bosons. Yep. Trying to add something like what are the fields here? What did I call them? Something like B alpha I B alpha I with an M squared to make that kind of a massive Klein-Gordon type of thing. Violates gauge invariance. No way when I change this to G B G inverse minus B G G inverse. Is this going to still work the same? So, not possible. So we have to be a little subtle in how we introduce masses for these things. And getting those gauge bosons right, it's tricky. It's not so tricky that like three people didn't think of it at once. Back in the early 50s or 60s. 60s, early 60s, I think. But you know, it takes some thoughtful insight to come up with a mechanism that will give those gauge bosons a mass and not violate the symmetry of the overall action. So there's one more class of problems here that is not so obvious, and I'll list it now that I'm taking the picture. The quark weak coupling are not just for the doublet. The doublet. The insight there is that, okay, we've got, let me just be another minute here. We set up these quark doublets thinking that the electroweak bosons would couple to those. So we've got up and down, charm, strange, truth and beauty quark. And you would think that, okay, this is like a weak doublet, so that SU2 is going to couple to this and allow the D to emit a W and become a U. Well, the D can emit a W and become a U, but in fact, the D can also emit a W and become a C or a T. So there's mixing between these. So the weak field couples to combinations. Let's call it, say, D prime is some combination of D and F and B, like that. And we'll talk about that. That leads to the Tabibo Kobayashi Maskawa matrix that tells us exact mixing for those. And we'll have to introduce that. So you see there are several things that are going to require us to introduce new features into this first shot at a Lagrangian that explains everything we've ever measured. But we actually get there, you know. So except for gravity. This really does a very, very good job of explaining the fundamental interactions that have ever been observed. There are very few problems with the ultimate model.
And gluons massless?
Gluons are massless, yes. Protons aren't. They got a lot of energy in there. That actually the quarks aren't very massive. The quarks, you know, like the up and down quarks, you know, have masses of maybe on the order of an MeV. So you got two up and down quarks.